Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Breast Cancer in the Next Generation conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. I would like to now turn the call over to Shiraj Dubovsky. Shiraj, you may begin.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us this evening for Sharsheret's national teleconference, Breast Cancer and the Next Generation, Caring for Our Children. My name is Shiraj Dubovsky, and I am the clinical supervisor at Sharsheret. I will soon have the pleasure of introducing tonight's speakers, all of whom will soon have will share their insights into what has become an important subject for those touched by breast cancer. You know, I frequently hear women saying, you know, somehow I've managed breast cancer to the best of my ability, but my greatest worry is for the emotional and physical well-being of my children. So our goal this evening will be to address the concerns you may be having for your children, from toddlers to young adults, and there will be a question and answer period following the presentation. Now, that being said, at any point during the conference, please feel free to press star 1 on your phone, and you will be pulled from the conference, and you can present your question to the operator. And once your question is given to the operator, they'll put you back into the conference call. We intend to offer some suggestions and guidance that may help you meet the needs of your children. In addition to this teleconference, I encourage you to contact Sharsheret for further support and resources, and I will give you that contact information at the end of the teleconference. I also strongly urge you to complete the evaluation form. We will be emailing you a form that you can complete online, or you can complete the evaluation form found in your teleconference packet. Our programs are driven and inspired by the feedback from our Sharsheret callers, so it's important that we continue to be able to tailor our programs based on your needs. The inspiration for this teleconference came on the heels of receiving a beautiful email from Allie Cooper, and we thought that there was no better way to introduce this teleconference. Allie, a Sharsheret volunteer, first got involved with Sharsheret in the spring of 2009 to honor the memory of her mother who passed away from breast cancer. By sharing her experiences, Allie hopes to offer insight to others as part of the support system that Sharsheret provides to women everywhere. So Allie, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Shira. As a Jewish woman with a family history of breast cancer, I know all too well the lasting impact that a parent's breast cancer diagnosis can have on a child and on a family. My grandmother, my mother's mother, passed away from breast cancer when my mother was a young child. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 42. I lost my mother to breast cancer when I was 8 years old, almost 20 years ago. When she was first diagnosed, I was 7 and my younger sister Sarah was 5. Because we were so young at the time, my mom did not think that Sarah and I needed to fully understand how sick she was or what was really going on. We were her little girls, and she wanted to make sure that we had a happy childhood and that we didn't think about scary things like breast cancer or death. It was very important to my mother to keep things as normal as possible around our house. Her doctor's appointments and treatment sessions were always scheduled during school hours or when we had after-school playdates. If my mom happened to be particularly weak or tired one day, my father would tell us that mommy just needed to catch up on sleep and keep us distracted so she could rest. Thinking back now, the only change we noticed around the house was a physical one, that my mom suddenly had very short hair. As a result of chemotherapy, my mom had lost most of her hair, and what she didn't lose was very thin and short. She went out and bought a curly wig, which I remember being a bit scared of since it made her look like a completely different person, in addition to some scarves and hats. When we asked her about her new look, she told us that she thought it might be fun to try a new hairstyle. Sarah and I may have told her we weren't such fans of the curly wig, because I don't really remember her wearing it all that often. Most of my memories of my mother at the time are of her wearing floppy straw hats. I think those are the ones she found easiest and most comfortable to wear, and they also happened to fit her personal fashion sense perfectly. While my mom was able to be at home with the family for most of the duration of her cancer, there were a few short hospital stays and times when we went to visit her there. Even in the hospital, where the stage was set to sit the two of us down and tell us what was going on, my mother's illness was never discussed in detail. Somewhere in the back of our minds, we must have known that clearly something was wrong. It had to be serious if she needed to spend nights in the hospital. But when we'd get there, she was the mommy we knew and recognized. She'd ask about our days, wanting to know what we learned in school, and making sure that all of our homework was done before we had come over. We loved talking with her and telling her every detail about our day and about our friends, and we would go on and on, dancing and playing around the hospital room until it was time to leave. I think we thought that as long as we had time with her, whether it was spent in our home or in the hospital, everything was okay. And soon enough, she was back in our apartment with us, and we just assumed she was slowly getting better. My father came home on a Shabbos morning and told us that Mommy had died. I remember being surprised and caught off guard that I hadn't realized that she was so sick and that the end had been near. I was upset that I hadn't been at the hospital with them, hadn't been able to say goodbye in person and tell her that I loved her and I would never forget her. But when you're 8 years old, how do you know when someone is really sick and close to death? It shouldn't be something that you'd be able to recognize easily. I cannot fault my mother and father for the way they handled the communication around my mother's illness. I can't imagine what it must have been like for her to receive such a grim diagnosis and then to come home and look at her two little girls who she knew she wouldn't be able to see grow up. A mother's first instinct is to protect her children, and I understand my parents wanting to shield my sister and I from the details of the disease that was about to change our family forever. As an adult, and as I look back on the past objectively, I am sorry for not knowing more details and not realizing that the time I had left with my mother was limited. It is both a scary and difficult thing to admit to your children that not only are you sick, but that you're scared, when it's you that your children look to as their biggest source for comfort and courage. So what should a mother recently diagnosed with cancer share with her children? As much as I appreciate my parents trying to protect me from all the pain they were going through, I wish my sister and I could have been involved more so that looking back on that time as adults, we felt as if we had been included. Even if we didn't know all the details, it would have been okay to tell us that Mommy was sick and that we should spend as much time as possible with her. This way, we could have cherished the moments we spent with her during her final months, knowing that they would be our last. I believe that one's family is the strongest support system, and if you don't let them in, you may miss out on one of the best kinds of supports available. Having a family history of breast cancer and being, as some would call, a patient in waiting, I know the importance of meeting with my high-risk doctors regularly and learning whatever I can about early detection and possible procedures. While I try to be well-educated and able to put on the bravest of faces, especially when discussing all of this with my husband, I often find some of the information frightening and overwhelming. Sharsheret offers a support system that not only enables but encourages families to open the lines of communication and feel comfortable discussing difficult issues. Had an organization like Sharsheret been around at the time of their diagnoses, my mother and grandmother could have benefited tremendously from the support the organization provides. Had they both had an opportunity to talk with other women who currently are or had previously gone through treatment, they may have been more comfortable discussing their illness and details with their families. Becoming part of a community of support may have inspired them to take full advantage of the time they had had left and to live each day to its fullest surrounded by those that they love the most.
Thank you, Allie. You certainly set a beautiful tone for tonight's discussion. Our next speaker is Tony Cabot. Tony is well accomplished and highly esteemed in the world of psychosocial oncology, and it would truly take days to read all her accomplishments, so I will share with you some of the highlights of Tony's career. Tony is the Director of Family Services and Organizational Development at High Lifeline. She came to High Lifeline from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where she was the Assistant Director of Social Work. Tony oversees many vital psychosocial programs, such as counseling centers throughout the greater New York City region, teleconference support groups and information lines, graduate and undergraduate field training, and is the project director for the Greater New York Komen for the Cure grant, meeting the needs of Orthodox Jewish women living with breast cancer. She was the recipient of the Eleanor Clark Award for Innovative Programs in Patient Care. Sharsheret has partnered with High Lifeline in the past, and we are proud of the working relationship that we share. Tony, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Gerard. Ellie, it was an inspiration to hear from you. I think, as Gerard shared with you, I have much professional experience in dealing with families where cancer, as we'll talk about, is maybe an unwelcome guest. I'm also going to rely upon the literature. There's much literature out there today, and I'll be talking and highlighting some books that may be useful, both for children and parents. And then similar to Ali, had my own personal experience that I think adds this, and probably was the impetus now that I look back of why I got into this field. And my own mother was also diagnosed with cancer when I was 12. And my experience may be somewhat different than Ali's, and realizing now, again, many of the opportunities were not there also many years ago. I'm much older than Ali. I won't say how much, but I am a grandmother myself, so you can imagine it was many years ago that I experienced a mom with cancer. Basically, what we're going to talk about today is integrating cancer into your family. As I said, many folks have described it as an unwelcome guest. No one invited it. No one's really happy to have it as part of the family. But the reality is, once a member of the family is diagnosed, and I think many oftentimes, especially if you have a mom, it affects the entire family. And it must be contended with. It really doesn't go away so easily. And I think today's conference is about how to address it. And I think first, for each mom and for each family, it's understanding your own style, your own tradition, your own culture, your own structure, your own rules, your own emotional makeup, your own history, and your own strength. No one can say to you from the outside, oh, this is what you should do, and this is how you can do it, because you're in the inside. All of us, when it's not our family, are outside. Your extended family is outside, your friends are outside, and those of us that are professionals now in the field, we're on the outside. So you really need to understand your own family style, take what I'm talking about tonight, and see how you can adapt it to your own family and to your own ability to communicate certain things or find other family members that can help communicate it. The approach that most of us are taking today is much more of a family-centered approach, whether it be in education, in mental health, and indefinitely in terms of oncology, when cancer, unfortunately, comes and visits your family. It's a wonderful book that I've relied upon, and it's a book by Wendy Schessel Harpam, and the name of the book is When a Parent Has Cancer. Wendy herself was a physician. When she was 36 years old, she was diagnosed with a form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Her own children were 2, 4, and 6. And as a result of the experience, she decided to write about herself and her diagnosis and what it's like being diagnosed with cancer. And one day while she was waiting for a reporter to come and interview her and talk about her book, her 7-year-old at the time asked if she could be interviewed. And the mom really took a cue from there and said to her, well, the reporter was coming to talk to her, but she thought that would be a great idea that she and her daughter can talk, and she would talk to her through interviewing her about what it's like for a child in the family when a mom has cancer. As a result of it, her book comes with a little compendium, and it's called Becky's Worry Cup. And it's basically the outcomes of her talking to her own child about what it's like for her to have a mom with cancer, and what are her concerns, and what are her worries. And from her book and Becky's book, we learn many, many things. One is obviously in talking to the children, it has to be an age-appropriate level. It's very different, and Ali, I think she talked about, you know, even two sisters in a family, if one is 3 and one is 10, it's a different conversation. If I was 12 as opposed to 3, maybe mom wouldn't have said the same kinds of things to me. So what you say to a child, depending upon their own age level, and even 2-3-year-olds may have different levels of sophistication, the language, the logic, their own preconceived notion, their own experiences, their ideas, including their own fears, hopes, and their faith, all developed with maturity in their chronological age. So what you're telling your child, how much you're talking to a child about your own diagnosis, what it means for the family, again, has a lot to do with that age of the child and the child's abilities. And all the information has to be, again, age appropriate. And what Wendy tells us in her book when she's talking about information is sometimes again, giving us maybe the courage to talk about it, what we all must do is look inside and find courage to face the future honestly with hope and love. So the information has to be delivered with the love and the hope, and again, in an age-appropriate fashion. What I wanted to do is talk about some books. I've mentioned Wendy's book, which I think is useful for a parent, a compendium which you could use with a child, my guess is 8 and up, 10 and up. Another book I want to mention is How to Help Children Through a Parent's Serious Illness, and that's Kathleen McHugh, and it was written in 1994. And again, these are two parent-oriented books. And you need some language sometimes in talking to children. And some of these books will give you some of that language. For younger children, more like 3 to 8, the wonderful book In Mommy's Garden, a book to help explain cancer to young children. And many of these books can be found on the Internet. And again, I understand this was recorded so that you could check on the transcript. And the author on that one is, spell it because I think it's harder to pronounce, but N-E-Y-A-L, Amary, A-M-M-A-R-Y. And in this book, very colorful, great pictures, but not big words, so it's good for younger children. She compares the weeds in the garden to cancer and the flowers to the healthy cell and uses that kind of analogy to explain to the children what cancer is like and what mommy is doing in terms of the garden. Another wonderful book that Louis Chirard brought to me and I wasn't as familiar with was Butterfly Kisses and Wishes on Wings, Ellen McKeever and Nancy Hirsch in 206. Again, the language is very simple, the pictures are beautiful, and helps explain to younger children what is going on. And a book that was written a little while ago, Mirrors Month by Deborah Weinstein Stern in 1994, I think could be used for a bit of a, you know, a little older child, and again, can give some of the language. In that book, the mom goes off and is in a hospital for a while, and that's the month that the child checks off and talks about how she contends with it and how she uses it. A very wonderful website also, if people are not familiar with it, is Kids Connected, K-I-D-S-K-O-N-N-E-C-T-E-D, in which you have many opportunities for older kids if they want to talk on online and also for parents to get some language. The key concepts that you're going to be conveying to the child is an openness as much as you can, is establish an openness. What is going on, again, whatever language that's age appropriate. The information, facts, love, and hopefulness, remember. Identify the positive and negative feelings and the experiences of a child. And understand the child's fundamental needs. And I think I'll talk a little about from the personal experience, again, that I can remember. I was 12, many years before cancer was even a word that was spoken, and oftentimes patients weren't even given that word as part of their diagnosis. But I think my mother, without some of the benefits of education that I had a very clear instinct that a child needed to know that their needs would be met. And she was clear and said, I'm going to the hospital. She would be away a while. At that point, children weren't even able to visit. You know, when Allie was talking about going to the hospital and playing around, I kind of went back many years and remembered children weren't even allowed up to the hospital. So I remember she reassured me that I would be brought by my dad. I could see her from a window and I could wave. I think she was assuring me that she'll be there for me and I would see it very concretely. And I can remember that visit. She also assured me if I needed anything and she wasn't available, to be in touch with my aunt. I was very close with my mother's older sister and my aunt, and my aunt was going to be there for me. She made it very, very clear. I knew the phone number. I knew the address. It was like, don't worry, there's a backup. And I remember her even saying, if mommy doesn't get better, you know you can call aunt. You know your aunt will be there for you. And again, this was meeting my fundamental needs, my concrete needs. Who was going to take care of me? If I needed something, who can I call? Because Daddy was going to be busy, you know, visiting Mommy. The third thing she did, a very, very concrete thing, and again, at that time, I didn't understand it. Now, looking back, I understand it a lot more. She gave me a small sum of money, and I still to this day can't remember. To me, I keep saying it's $20, but sounds now that sounds like a lot of money now, you know, back then. But to me, it seemed like a large sum of money, but it was probably a small sum of money. And she said, listen, if there's anything that you need while I'm not here and if Daddy is busy, you know, you can go right around the corner to the store and pick up ice cream or anything you wanted, and left me in charge of this money. So all of these things were taking care of my fundamental needs. I knew where to go. I knew I wasn't alone. There was someone a phone call away. I knew I'd get to see her. And I knew I could be in charge of this little sum of money, which I think in many ways shaped my life and made me a very responsible person. And I think we can talk about some of the benefits that come out of this. I was reassured I was going to be cared for. I knew who was available in her absence. You know, a lot of times moms can't do all of this, and they can't say all of this. So what happens if you're overwhelmed? You can't handle all of this. Are there other people that can help explain some things to your child, your spouse, other family members, healthcare professionals? And sometimes and many times they'll say, well, we'll be able to talk to the children, but we'd want a family member. I don't think it's a great idea for a social worker to be telling a kid, oh, this is what's wrong with mom, this is why you won't see her. But many times mom or dad can use the strength and some of the language of also a professional. And some parents have said, well, they haven't asked, so if they don't ask, I'm not going to say anything. And I think most of us say, take some initiative. Start to tell them some things, again, age appropriate. Use the resources, Share It, we've heard about many other resources here, many of the websites, the books. Best to tell them in a quiet place, one child at a time. And again, keep things simple, direct, and maybe not everything all at once. I know some of the parents have submitted questions and tried to give the children so much information that sometimes it's a little bit of overload, and they go back to some simple question like, well, why aren't you better when you're coming home? And again, many of us struggle with, do we use the word cancer? I think each family has to deal with this in their own family structure. Some families are very open, very comfortable, very able. Some families are not as comfortable. And many of us encourage you to try that, see where your level of comfort is, and find other words. I think also you need to prepare yourself before you start talking to them with the questions they'll ask. When will you get better? Will you get better? Can I get cancer? How did you get cancer? What if Daddy gets cancer? Can I get cancer? Will you be able to come to my baseball game? And these are the very basic questions oftentimes that any discussion that opened will lead to. And sometimes if you prepare yourself when you get the question, you'll be in a better shape to learn, to handle it. I think lessons can be learned from this. Can any good come from this? And I think that's an important part. And sometimes the children learning, yeah, I'm not going to look well. I think Allie has talked about, you know, the sparse hair and the funny wig. And that's maybe time to lesson about what's outside that people see. But inside, she was the same mom. She may not have been, you know, she may have been bald and puffy, and maybe there's a weight change and she was tired. But inside, she was the same mom, and they need to learn some of those lessons. Sometimes understanding about the loss of health, the loss of health and the change of a health status. And also how to deal with stress, worry, and uncertainty. Remember I mentioned to you the companion book that comes with Wendy Harpin's book, When a Parent Has Cancer. It's called Becky's Worry Cup. And recognizing that her daughter had worries, and how could she help the daughter deal with the worries? And again, she establishes routine of a worry cup. Also the lesson of change and adaptation. Change will happen for all of us and all families. And with the mother's illness, any change in the family, how do we adapt? And the lesson of flexibility. Remember, one of the best things I learned from abnormal psychology from the professor was the sign of mental health was flexibility. It's good that children have a routine, go to bed the same time, get up the same time, wash their teeth, take their bath, but they need to learn about flexibility too. When mommy isn't feeling well, we can take a later bath. We could, you know, have somebody else help us with our homework. From this, many times children will be empowered. How can they help themselves? How can they help the family? Don't put too much on their plate, but maybe it's time they can set the table. Maybe they can be involved in preparing a meal so that they can be part of the new family structure. The children are resilient. Family priorities may have to change. Your priorities may have to change. I know one thing I often talk to mothers about is, what can you give away? And I say, what do you mean? Well, you're so used to doing the cooking, the cleaning, the laundry, the many different activities in the household. If you couldn't do one of them, and maybe someone else could do it, or some service could do it, what would it be so that you could keep your energy bank account, so that you could save your energy, maybe something you could do with the children, or something they could help with? I think important is never to speak about them in front of them or earshot. I mean, many times people say, oh, they don't hear, and then oftentimes you'll know the kids heard everything. I know one mom talked about submitted some questions and said, but I didn't want to tell her about whatever, the drainage bottles or this or that, and the kid from the corner of her eye saw them and started asking questions. Anything that you can do if you can't be there, and set up a substitute ritual or routine will help also. If you can't be there for nighttime, what you could do is maybe set up a tape recording and go through the ritual, and a child could follow along. Or they could write a letter to you every day if you're in the hospital. Or video the play that you can't see and then bring it back so that you can see it. We can show it to the other family members. Or maybe use a computer hookup for long-distance communication if you have to be out of town for a while for treatment. Turn some of these obstacles into opportunities. I go back to my experience again. Remember the small sum of money that Mom gave me. I think I was very proud when she came back home. I set up what now I know is a spreadsheet, showed her what I spent it on, and how much more I had to give back to her when she returned. That lesson stays with me today. I manage money very, very well, never was afraid of it, and I think it came from that very, very simple experience, and the obstacle maybe became the opportunity. Also a place where cancer doesn't invade. Remember I said it becomes the unwelcome guest, but is there an island in the house that no cancer exists? Maybe it's the kitchen, the dining room, a place where cancer doesn't take over your world and their world. A time when we're not talking about illness, when we're talking about other things that are going on in the family. Shirai, how am I doing for time?
I would say maybe another 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay, just wanted to check because I'm losing track.
Okay.
So in the final conclusions in the last few minutes, what I'd like to do is maybe talk about what happens if there's some disappointments. If a child says, I thought you'd be over this, I thought you'd better. Or the child themselves starts to show some physical symptoms. They're not feeling well. There's regressive behavior. They're acting more childlike. They forgot their toilet training. They're blaming themselves. It's my fault that you're sick. They're showing unusual fears or anxieties. They become aggressive. They withdraw. They become quiet. They have sleeping, eating difficulties. I think, again, you need to assess, are they short-term? Is it stress? And you verbalize some things for them, help them along with this, some reassurance. Or, again, at this point, do they need some intervention, someone to kind of assess, is this more than very, very temporary? But the more you can verbalize their disappointment, their anger, their loss, and their sadness, and balance it with hopefulness and appreciation for what they're going through, it may be able to help them. Sometimes we've talked about finding the silver lining. You know, we always talk about, you know, the cloud and the silver lining in the cloud. What can they get from this? What can they learn? What have they grown from? And many times they will be able to help you with this. Some famous child books that have nothing to do with cancer that many parents have used in helping their children grow up. The Little Engine That Could, or The Famous Wizard of Oz and The Lion of Courage. And I think many of you will, you know, cite many biblical figures that faced adversity. How can they deal with this kind of adversity? Be conscious of all times to use, wherever you can and however you can, the laughter, the distraction, again, that island of no cancer. And play is a very therapeutic tool. Kids love to play and maybe express themselves to play. Ending in terms of saying, make use of many of the books out there, many of the resources out there that'll give you some of the language, some of the words to use in talking with your children. The professional helpers, the social workers, the psychologists, the rabbis, the communal leaders. And a book that was well known a while ago, and I kind of reframed it, saying it takes a village to raise the children, not just one parent. So I think using all these resources in helping discuss your diagnosis in the family with young children would be helpful. Thanks a lot.
Tony, thank you. We're particularly grateful for how much important information you were able to provide us in such a small amount of time. I just wanted to remind everybody that at any point you can press star 1 if you have any specific questions. So at this point, I will now introduce myself. I am Sharsheret's clinical supervisor. I have served as a psychology resident and fellow at the Bronx Psychiatric Center of the Albert Einstein School of Medicine and an associate psychologist for the Jewish Board of Family and Children's Services. I have worked as a researcher at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center And as Sharsharit's clinical supervisor, I assist women newly diagnosed and at high risk of developing breast cancer, in addition to providing supportive counseling to women living with metastatic breast cancer. And really, the way that I see this evening unfolding is I feel like we're putting layers. By all of us sharing our experiences, we're adding layers. So I really want to do that and add on to what Ali and Tony have already shared. June 26, 1978, I'll always remember that date. It was my parents' anniversary, and we were all gathered at my aunt's house to celebrate. After the meal, all the kids dispersed, and then we were summoned back to the table. I was 13 years old at the time, and my parents stood and announced that they had some difficult news to share. My mom said that she had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and that was all I heard. Apparently, I missed the part about it spreading to the other parts of the body, because just the words breast cancer sent me into a fog. I didn't exactly know what cancer was, and in those days, no one voiced the words cancer. There was no internet, no Oprah Winfrey, no Susan G. Komen, and most unfortunately, no Sharsharit. I remember looking around the table for clues on how to respond to this, and everybody responded so differently. My aunt was crying. My grandfather really was silent, and I remember him standing still. My parents continued talking, and they assured us that we were going to fight this with everything they had. All of us kids just sat and watched, except for my 10-year-old brother. And I don't know what it was, maybe a lack of fear, lack of reservations, perhaps simply a lack of knowledge. And he was the first one to speak up. So innocently, he said, well, what's that? And to be honest, I don't remember what my mom said. I do remember that as she spoke, her initial bravado softened and she became teary, and that was very hard to watch. Subsequently, I learned that my 41-year-old mom had been diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. My parents traveled all over the world for second, third, fourth opinions, yet the opinions didn't differ, and the consensus was that my mom had little time left. My parents were very open with us about the cancer, about treatment, and about their feelings, and I often wonder if maybe they were too open. But then again, I also think that my brain only processed what it could. My defenses protected me by only taking in as much information as my psyche could tolerate. In hindsight, I am better able to understand the dynamics within my family. Unconsciously, we each assumed a different role in the family that represented all the emotions we were experiencing collectively. So let me elaborate, because I think this is important. As we experience trauma, we become a more extreme version of ourselves, a magnified version, and in some cases, a caricature of ourselves. If someone is a doer, then they move into hyperaction mode. If someone is by nature a worrier, then that becomes heightened. My dad was a pulpit rabbi in a conservative synagogue, so his baseline was to be public and rely on his congregants for logistical and emotional support. There were certainly no private moments. My mom, the Rebbetzin, also a public figure, wanted more privacy and primarily wanted support from her family and close friends. My 16-year-old brother never used emotional language. He never discussed conflict or struggles and just went about his life studying, sports, and friends. My 10-year-old brother had no filter, and he would say what everyone was thinking but would never dare say aloud. I was the emotional one. Perhaps because I was the only girl, a middle child, I carried the emotions for the family. It was really the perfect storm. Having just turned 13, my hormones were stirring up, and I had just started middle school. And now my mom, my role model, my only trace of estrogen in the house, was fighting for life. Collectively, we were all these things. I think we all wanted to shout it out to the world, to solicit help from every possible source out there. Collectively, we needed a boundary, some privacy. I think all of us wanted to go on with our lives as if this wasn't really happening. I think we all wanted the freedom to say what we were thinking without emotional repercussions. And I'd like to believe that we all felt angry and scared, worried for my mom's well-being as well as our own. We each took ownership of these different aspects of coping, and together as a family, we lived with advanced breast cancer. There were times that I felt angry that we were all reacting and coping so differently. But now, 25 years later, I think by each taking a piece, we gave each other a gift. We couldn't be all these things. We would be too overwhelmed. We would have just imploded. We needed someone to be the calm one, another to be the warrior, another to remind us that we needed to normalize our lives. I am grateful to my younger brother for soliciting information that I would never have had the courage to seek out. Now, I'm ambivalent about having been the one to carry the emotions. I had so much anger, but I felt tremendous guilt when I expressed these feelings. And I remember worrying that my emotions would be the cause of emotional pain for my parents, as if somehow that pain didn't already exist within them. I appreciated that my parents shared information directly and openly, and there were maybe one or two times that I overheard my parents speaking to one another or with someone else, and I was pained by what I had heard, as Tony had mentioned. And now that I have my own kids, I'm reminded how somehow kids manage to hear everything, and they manage to see the things that we're trying to hide. 25 years ago, there was no internet, no Googling. Now, the downside of this is that we were very limited as to the information that was available to us. Another downside is that well-intentioned people often shared anecdotal information that was either irrelevant or just outright wrong, heightening our anxiety. Now, the advantage of not having internet was that the information my parents shared with us was tailored to the unique set of variables pertaining to my mom. Today, our children have access to the internet. We speak more openly about breast cancer, but again, this also has its pros and cons. I highly recommend that when speaking with your teenage children, you need to remember that you are setting the emotional tone for how the family will face cancer. You may want to remind them that they may hear or read about a lot of information regarding breast cancer, but there exists a unique set of variables that are relevant to your cancer. I appreciated that my parents offered us the option to go speak with the oncologist. Now, I felt reassured that we were really in good hands after speaking to the oncologist, because somehow it was one thing hearing it from my parents, but there was a different level of validity when we heard information directly from the medical team. My spontaneous memories of my teenage years revolve more around my social life than my mom's cancer. And my parents managed to create a new normal in the household. We went to school, engaged in after-school activities. We were involved in the synagogue. We went to camp, just like all the other kids. Every week, a different person took my mom to chemo treatments, and this was also normal and routine, for us at least. Sometimes I would go with my mom and her friend, and I remember the waiting room where everyone was so happy to see her. And this, by the way, was not normal to me, but not for the reasons that you would think. My mom had my then 8-year-old cousin draw a placard that she wore as an old-fashioned sandwich board to her treatments, which included a word of profanity not appropriate for this presentation. And attached to this board were colorful helium balloons enough to seemingly lift my mom off the ground. So one day, there was a new nurse on the shift, and upon seeing my mom, the nurse called the psychiatric unit to see if a patient had escaped. And this vision still makes me laugh even 25 years later. What I remember most from my visits to treatment was not the hospital, but the lunches that followed. It was a ladies' day out, and I felt so included. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have to bring your kids to treatment or doctor's appointment. My point is that my parents at least, kept to the routine. And I now understand that every household has their own routine, and that one seemed normal for us. By establishing a routine, it normalized my experience, and I felt safe emotionally and well taken care of. I don't want to mislead you, because things weren't always calm and routine. Things got loud and chaotic at times. We had sibling rivalry, fights with parents, squabbles with the friends, problems in school, and I suspect that it was difficult for my parents to know how much of our behaviors were connected to our feelings about my mom having cancer, or how much of it was typical teenage behavior. Teenagers, by their very essence, are unpredictable. I suppose that this becomes exaggerated when facing difficult and painful challenges. I remember one time my mom asking me directly, "Are you reacting this way because you're worried about me?" So who can answer that as a teenager? You know, how would I know what's typical teenage behavior or what's a reaction to cancer? It's difficult to know the ingredients that contribute to one's behaviors. When we see a cake, we know that it contains milk, flour, eggs, sugar, salt, and so on. What we don't know when we are presented with a cake is how much of these ingredients were used. And it's the same when coping with cancer. We know that there are many contributing factors, ingredients. How much of it's typical teenage behavior versus a response to cancer remains an unknown. We should just assume that all these ingredients that are found in this cake called teenagers coping with a parent with cancer is somehow found in this cake. As I give my teenage years more thought, I think I was ambivalent about my level of independence. On the one hand, it is developmentally appropriate for teenagers to separate from their parents, spending more time with their peers. I did this, but at a cost. I remember worrying about my mom, thinking that maybe I should stay closer to home. My parents discouraged this as much as possible, encouraging me to partake in the typical teenage activities. I don't remember talking about my mom's illness at any great length with my friends. Throughout the 6 years that my mom lived with cancer, I can only recall two distinct conversations I had with a peer about what was going on with my mom. And it's hard to remember if this was due to my wanting to maintain privacy or if I just didn't think my peers would be able to relate to what I was going through. I think on some level that my brothers and I responded differently because of our difference in genders. Adolescence is a time when our bodies are changing. As I was developing breasts, a time when most girls are feeling good about development, I remember wondering if my breasts would someday cause me to have a serious illness. As I developed rest, my mom was losing hers. As much as I wanted to be like my mom, I remember having a conversation with her about finding the differences. I think we were both secretly happy that I began menstruating at a later age than she. Perhaps if there were enough differences, somehow I would maybe dodge the bullet of ever having breast cancer. My brothers didn't struggle with this issue, though they certainly had their own unique concerns. In retrospect, I wish that my parents had a better sense of the areas that were appropriate for me to help in the caregiving and those that weren't. Certainly, it felt important for me to help in the house, to assist my parents with certain tasks. However, there were areas that were just not appropriate for me to be helping my mom, and that boundary was sometimes blurred. I advise parents to be cognizant of these boundaries and to not expect their teenage children to take on too many added responsibilities. I just want to briefly expand on the issue of boundaries. I think concerned people in our lives perceive teenagers as being old enough to field questions or share thoughts about a parent's illness. I remember feeling put off and uncomfortable when I would be at the synagogue or in town and people would approach me with questions. First of all, I just wanted to go about my normal routine. I also think that I was more fragile than I appeared, even though outwardly it seemed as if I was a confident, outgoing teenager. I suggest moms to try to encourage friends and families not to use their children as conduits for information. When I look back on my adolescence, I appreciate that my parents didn't focus on the big events or the big ticket items. My parents understood that quality time, hanging out, and just simply spending time together was all we needed. My spontaneous memories of that time in my life are not the bar and bat mitzvahs, were not the times we spent on vacations. My spontaneous memories were that I started my day with my mom cuddling with me. I remember when I came home, she always sat with me and asked me about my day. I remember family dinners or hanging out with her on her bed. It was the day-to-day interactions that were the milestones. So what are the takeaways? Remember that you are the expert when it comes to each of your children. Each child will have a different reaction and will have different needs. Encourage your teens to talk about their feelings, but realize they may find it easier to speak with friends or teachers or rabbis, or they may prefer to handle it privately. Talk about the changes in the household and let them know what to expect, but that you will try to keep things as routine as possible. Remind them that their emotional and physical needs remain a priority. Encourage them to maintain activities and friendships. Set appropriate limits regarding caretaking, and don't rely on them to take on too many added responsibilities. As much as you can, try to encourage friends and family not to use your children as conduits for information. offer them resources or access to your medical team if they seem to have questions or concerns. If you, and Tony spoke about this, and I want to emphasize it, if you see that they are exhibiting significant changes in mood, appetite, sleep habits, socialization, or school performance, you may want to consider counseling. In the information packet that we sent out, there is a wonderful guide called When Your Parent Has Cancer, a Guide for Teens, and I encourage you to look at that. Also, I invite you to look at the transcript on the Sharsheret website, www.sharsheret.org, and look for the transcript, How Do We Care for Our Children? I would also consider journaling or documenting your life. I wish that I had my mom's own words when it comes to her life, from her childhood to my childhood. Regardless of where you are in your journey, whether recently diagnosed or whether you are post-treatment with no evidence of disease, I invite you also to look at the transcript, Take It From Me, My Experience in My Own Words, for tips on getting your stories and thoughts down for your children. At some point, it may seem like cancer ends. For most women today, it comes when a woman is said to have no more evidence of disease. For other women, like my mom, it came when she passed away. Many people in our support systems want to just move on as if cancer is over. We are changed forever because we have been touched by cancer. Fears of recurrence or fears that family members may be diagnosed with cancer are strong. The lingering impact lasts for years, both in the positive and negative aspects. It's important to remember that this is true for your children as well. Whenever I see a new doctor and they take down my family history, I'm reminded. Whenever I read something about cancer or hear about someone with cancer, I'm reminded. When I have to go for routine exams or screenings, I'm reminded. Whenever I'm faced with challenges, I remember the gifts that my parents gave me. I remember to stare challenges straight in the eyes and decide that it will not break me. I remember to rely on resources and support systems to help me through the journey. I don't have to go it alone. I remember to laugh even during life's scariest moments. I remember to embrace the everyday moments and to not live for the big milestones. It's 25 years later for me, and it still touches me. But my brothers and I, we're okay, and I wanted you all to know that that outcome exists. It's now my pleasure to introduce Niecy Singer-Schoenberger, Sharsheret's Genetic Program Coordinator. Niecy graduated from Sarah Lawrence College with a Master's of Science in Human Genetics. She has provided genetic counseling in all aspects of genetics for the past 10 years. And has focused on cancer genetics. She is a founding member of the National Society of Genetic Counselors and a past president of the Human Genetics Association of New Jersey. Niecy provides supportive counseling, information, and resources regarding hereditary breast cancer to women diagnosed and are at high risk of developing breast cancer. Niecy approaches each interaction with expertise, warmth, and patience, as women have shared their deep concerns around hereditary breast cancer, genetic testing, and its implications. So, Niecy, I now hand the floor over to you.
Thank you, Shira, and thank all of you for these personal stories that are so insightful and helpful. My discussion tonight will be less personal, but framed by a scenario in which a woman has been diagnosed with breast cancer, had genetic testing, and is found to carry a mutation in a BRCA gene. The dilemma then is if or when to discuss this with her 18-year-old daughter, whose risk now of carrying a mutation, if you do, is 50%. And of course, there's also a 50% chance of her not carrying the mutation. For many years, the prevailing wisdom in the genetics community has been that one does not test minors if no medical interventions are indicated. In 2003, the American Society of Clinical Oncology stated, quote, when no risk reduction strategies are available and the probability of developing a malignancy during childhood is very low, for instance, with hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, testing should not be offered, unquote. But it's not that clear cut today. and guiding an 18-year-old after your diagnosis of breast cancer and a positive mutation result can be fraught with uncertainty and misgivings. The question as to what and when to tell her and how to advise her can be overwhelming. There have been numerous studies performed over the years to look at the best way to address these very questions. But despite professional guidelines recommending against testing minors, there is ongoing debate over the testing of minors for the BRCA mutations and other adult-onset genetic disorders. The debate is essentially over the rights of the parents to have information that can optimize the ongoing health care of their children against the rights of the children to have their best interests protected and to make their own decisions about whether they'll actually want the information when they become adults. As we heard just a little while ago, children and older adults and older adolescents have access to the internet now, where they can learn everything they want to know about genetic testing. And certainly the media and TV cover the subject almost daily. So they know a lot more and more comfortable with genetic testing than adolescents did in previous years when these guidelines were put forth. Studies on the subject of when to tell are divided and offer, unfortunately, no good advice to parents facing this dilemma. In a 2007 study, it was found that only a very minority of children had problems with understanding the implications of the information, and a similar minority had negative results to the disclosure of the cancer and the test results. We'd all agree, of course, that a parent shouldn't burden a child with her own problems or test her daughter in order to reassure herself. However, open communication leads to less guilt and less secrecy. One study showed that if the parent shares the worry with her daughter, there's less depression on the part of both of them, in addition to positive adjustment for both. I'm going to give you some of the potential risks and benefits of sharing the information and encouraging or not encouraging your daughter to test at this age. Against testing at age 18 is the fact that there is no medical indication or timely benefit to knowing if she's a carrier. There are no risk reduction options recommended until age 25, when clinical breast exams and mammography would begin. Also, an 18-year-old may be too immature to deal with the information and make an informed decision as to whether or not to undergo testing. Having her parents know her genetic status violates her right to confidentiality, which may cause her a great deal of distress. It should be recognized that she'll benefit from having the opportunity to participate in the decision-making process when she's old enough to do so, but may not understand the implications for her future if she tests as a minor. Having a mutation means that the risk for ovarian cancer is increased, as well as the risk for breast cancer. Since there's no reliable screening tool at this time to detect ovarian cancer at an early stage, the recommendation is removal of the ovaries once childbearing is completed. So a mutation carrier would be advised to have her children earlier rather than later. Also, depending on which gene is involved, there may be risks for other cancers as well. Facing these possibilities can cause an 18-year-old increased anxiety and dread of the future. Knowing that she carries a mutation that predisposes her to cancer will become part of her self-concept as she matures. As an adult, she may even decide that she doesn't want to know her mutation status, and she's entitled to have the option of making that decision for herself. On the other hand, in support of informing and/or testing at this age is the idea that this may foster preventative behaviors early, change her early health habits, teach her about breast self-exams, and inform childbearing decisions. Also, knowing can bring relief from uncertainty and allow her and the family to make informed choices for the future, including plans for health care, career, and reproduction. Many 18-year-olds are mature enough to handle the information and to make their own informed consent to either test or not to test. After considering these potential risks and benefits, most experts have still concluded that predictive testing of minors for adult-onset diseases is not appropriate unless specific medical interventions are recommended prior to adulthood, or the request is voluntary and comes from a competent and informed adolescent. The determination to delay testing until adulthood is also based on the speculative nature of the psychological benefits and harms. Parents have to respect the child's right to dissent to testing despite their own urge to know. Obviously, there's no right or wrong answers to this dilemma, only a caution to weigh the pros and cons in light of what you know about your daughter, her level of maturity, and her desire to hear the information. If she tests and is negative, that's amazingly reassuring, and her risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer in her lifetime is the same as anyone else in the general population. But if she tests positive, the burden of that knowledge can change the way she sees herself and her future. It could also bring her relief from uncertainty. And so your discussion with her, if you decide to have that discussion, has to be cognizant of the implications of the knowledge you're offering, as well as her desire or lack of desire to know. There's plenty of time now for your questions and comments, so please let us know your thoughts on any aspect of the teleconference, and Sherrod, Tony, Alan, Allie, and I will be happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Nisi, thank you for taking such complicated information and sharing it in such a manageable and understandable manner. So we are now going to open the floor for questions and answers. Again, please press star 1, and you can pose your question to the operator, and they will get it to me. In the meantime, we did receive several questions prior to the teleconference. And Tony, you did, in your presentation, address some of the questions that were brought in, but I would like to emphasize one, and that is when the one daughter, a 11-year-old daughter, asked her mom, when is this all going to be over, and when are you going to be 100% better? And her question is, I don't even know the answer to that, so how do I begin to respond to her? So, Tony, if you could take that question.
Sure. I think it's a million-dollar question that not only her daughter has, that we all have, and sometimes part of it is the honesty. And we talked about the open communication and the trust and the honesty, and maybe being able to say, you know, I'm going through it with the doctors, and everything I know from the doctors I will share with you as much as appropriate and possible. And you may not know at what point you're 100% better and when it's going to be all over. But as you go along the process, we'll share with her. And I think it's the disappointment that a child is sharing and that we all share, that it's not going along to the rules that we wanted and hoped for, that everything would be fine. And I think any one of us going into any medical procedure is all hopeful of coming out of it feeling pretty good the day or two or three or four afterwards and realize the recuperation process is taking longer than we anticipated. And maybe sharing that with her and being there for her will help her a little bit along the way. There's no certainty. And maybe just letting her know that we're there with her during that uncertainty.
Thank you, Tony. Nisi, a question came in for you. You spoke a lot about 18-year-olds. My daughter is 14, and she is very concerned that she will be at risk for developing cancer. Any suggestions on how I should address this with her?
I think the first thing you have to do is to begin with what she already knows. As I said, there's so much information out there. So it's important to know what she already knows about cancer and about the inheritance of cancer, and also to find out what her questions are before you start just giving her a lot of information. Because I think as Shira said, you can answer too many questions that are not pertinent to what she's really asking. I think that in terms of the inheritance of it and the possibility of it, I would even start with saying that most breast cancers are not inherited, if she's concerned about her own risks. And that's the truth. 90 to 95% of breast cancers are not inherited. And so that can be reassuring for her. I think what Shira suggested about having her go with you, if she is mature enough to handle that, to go to a visit with the oncologist or to participate in your treatments, can also be very reassuring for her. I don't think that going into the genetic testing aspect is really appropriate for a 14-year-old, but if she knows about it, then I think you do have to discuss it with her.
Okay, thank you, Nisi. Another question came in. My kids are 6, 8, and 9, and I worry about how they will think about going to doctors or about illness in general. So, Allie, the question goes to you. Do you feel tainted by your mom's experience?
Well, I first think it's important to address the ages of the kids. Like Tony alluded to before, you know your children and you know what's age appropriate. And what you would necessarily share with the 6-year-old about doctor's visits might not be the same way you would present it to your 9-year-old. We really weren't brought to doctor's visits or included in that conversation. I don't know how much my younger sister would have benefited from something like that. I think if I had heard a little bit about it that was age appropriate, I would have felt better about it. And I also think your kids are following your lead. You know, so if you go into the doctor's office with a brave face, you discuss what's going on, again, to whatever appropriate level is appropriate, and they'll follow your lead. And if they think you're being brave and informing them, they'll feel just as brave and secure about it.
Okay. And Tony, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think, you know, the piece we said about, again, making sometimes the silver lining in the cloud, and the taking the opportunity for teaching and learning moments is that, you know, none of us approach going to the doctor's visit with great glee, but know it's something that we need to do, and in the long run, that doctor's visit, if it uncovers something, will bring us treatment quickly. And I think that's the piece that needs to kind of be conveyed, you know, to the child, recognizing the apprehension, recognizing that it's not something anyone wants to do because none of these procedures sound like fun. But at the same time, we do believe in keeping our health up and improving our health. And for that reason, we feel that we're taking something proactive. And even if you can compare it to something less intrusive and less invasive, but on the same principle, it's brushing your teeth. Very few kids really want to get up there and go brush their teeth, but they kind of learn pretty quickly that this is helpful to me. And in the long run, I will need less of the dental care. So it kind of makes it kind of, you know, part of the routine and that participating it. But I'm not sure about their involvement, again, in going into the oncologist unless they're very age appropriate and needing more information from that visit.
Great. Tony, here's another one.
You're keeping me busy tonight.
Yeah, actually, we have a
okay.
Line of questions here. So stick with us here. How do I discuss a mastectomy with an 11-year-old child?
You know, again, it goes back to maybe some of the things that Nisi said, is what have you told the child about what you're going for? Does she understand about the bad cancer cells and how they can be harmful to you? And when you have something bad, that it has to be removed, and how, you know, it can be removed. And again, going from the simple to, let's say, the bump on your hand that needs to be removed, the mole or whatever, to then obviously a more intimate body part, such as the breast, and that it is something that will not only help you, but also save your life from that bad cancer cells spreading throughout your body. But I think it's taking it from the simple notion of why something is being removed to obviously the more complex notion of a part of your body that is being removed. And again, following the child's need, not jumping into many complicated explanations unless the child at that point, you know, as we go further down, starts to ask the questions. And if she starts to ask, I think then you have to be prepared to tell her.
Well, I guess that would probably be true for this next question, which is, how do I address questions about reoccurrence with my 4-year-old?
Come on again, right? Okay, we had a lot of young ones today. And again, what does a 4-year-old know about reoccurrence? It's the same question of at age level.
Correct.
That, you know, mommy has been sick, and could mommy get sick again? You know, in all honesty, you can't say yes or no because you don't really know. You know, it goes back to maybe that first question about the uncertainty. It would be very nice if we all could say, whether it be to our children, even to ourselves, that something will never come back again and everything is going to be fine. But we know that we all live with a certain amount of uncertainty in the real world because we don't know that answer. So I think we explain to the child that we're hoping that something doesn't come back again, just like the bad cold that the child may have had, or the chicken pox or the flu or something else like that. But we know that sometimes it does come back. And just like we had medication, treatment, help the first time, we'll have medication, help, and treatment the second time. And again, stay age-appropriate since it's a 4-year-old.
Okay, I guess maybe I'll field this one. The question is, how does one deal with the emotional aspect? What about unexpressed fears, crying? So I would have to say that what's true for you as the parent, I think is true for the kids as well. One of the things that I'm sure many of you experienced when you've called me here at Shosheret and had that first phone call, you know, sometimes you would become teary or start to cry and then feel apologetic about it. And my response to that is, I'm always glad to hear that you're taking an emotional hit, because that to me at least seems like the rational response to such an irrational situation. So I actually think that it's healthy for your children to see you crying about this and hearing words like, you know, I'm scared too, but I want you to know that I'm being as responsible as I can be in terms of having my doctors, in terms of the treatments that I'm pursuing, so that, you know, I'm very confident about my treatment team, but even so, it can feel scary at times. So I think that it's important to be able to model for them that the whole range of the emotional experience is important, because I think at the end of the day, it will validate their own emotional experiences. Tony, you're back on again. A question came in about the parent is trying to filter information based on what they think would be protective to their children. And there have been occasions where either the child has seen something or has overheard something and has confronted the parent on that. So I guess the question would be is, how do you know if you're filtering properly?
That's another million-dollar question. And I guess the best way of knowing is that the child feels comfortable enough to come back with the question and ask you. Again, mommy, you said this, but I see that. What does it mean? And I think that means that you've established an openness about the communication. And I think, remember, as you said, Sherat, you can't tell all the kids, all different ages, all the things, and sometimes felt a little overexposed if you got too many details. So I think it's natural for a parent to try to filter some things, again, age-appropriate and understanding the child. But then if the child comes back and says, well, but what about that, or I heard that, or I saw this, then you have to keep those wonderful lines of open communication that you already started and really congratulate the child for coming back and asking some more and maybe taking that deep breath and going to the next level of explanation. Remember I said, like, when you start the conversation, you kind of have to think through some of those questions that they might ask, like, can I get it? How'd you get it? Can it happen to somebody else? Are you going to die? So it's the same thing. You filtered, and maybe appropriately so, and then the child sees something, hears something, and you need to then be able to answer. Because I think as long as the child hears that you're being open and you're helping them with as much information that you have and that you feel that they can handle and that they're comfortable coming back to you, that you've been very, very successful with it.
Great. Thank you, Tony. A question came in for me that we had mentioned some books, but the teens are technologically advanced. So somebody is asking what websites would be helpful and in a Jewish vein as opposed to just Googling. So as we all know, our kids may just end up Googling, but what I've recommended to moms in the past is to actually make a list of websites that you have felt comfortable with. So for example, Kids Connected is a great website to go to. I think, you know, some of the reliable websites for breast cancer that I always go to are, for example, breastcancer.org. And I plug in my questions there. I think I would encourage your teens to do those searches with you so that you're sure that they are putting in the proper information. The other thing that I think is important is that we have a program called Ask Sharsheret and Family Focus, and I certainly would encourage you to either have your teens call me directly or that you can call me and ask for specific information in terms of how to present it to your teen. So I just want to give one more opportunity for questions. Okay. I think as we wrap up this evening, I'd like to thank all the speakers for their wisdom and warmth in discussing the emotional and physical well-being of children whose lives have been touched by breast cancer. Please be sure to complete the evaluation forms you've received in your information packet or online. Your feedback is very, very important to us. And again, I encourage you to reach out to Sharsheret for further support and resources. The phone number is 866-474-2774, or you can even email me directly at sdubitsky@sharsheret.org. Two things. One is if there are further questions, you can certainly send me an email or call me directly, and I will make sure that the questions get to the appropriate presenter this evening, and they have agreed to respond to those questions. Additionally, if you have not received the information packet, please feel free to contact Sharsheret, and we can certainly get that out to you. I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. Facing breast cancer is a frightening experience unto itself, and the lasting impact it can have on children is deep and emotional for the many reasons that we discussed tonight. I believe our speakers have offered guidance and insight into how to make this journey for and with your children a more meaningful experience. It's the Jewish imperative, Ushmartem Me'od Et Nafshe Techem, to care for ourselves, our collective selves, and most importantly, our children today and in the future. Good night.